If you're experiencing difficulty, please reach out for support. You can reach QLife, an anonymous and free LGBTI support service, by calling 1800 184 527 or call Lifeline 24 hours a day on 13 1114 for crisis support and suicide prevention. In an emergency, please call 000.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network to over 70 community stations around the nation. This is Word for Word, hosted by Lisa Dano Daniel, coming to you from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy.
Hi, welcome to Word for Word. I'm your host, Lisa Dano Daniel. Today's guest has been a fixture of Melbourne queer life for what seems like decades. His contributions have spanned the queer club scene, as well as queer media, queer events, and his current roles as Media and Communications Officer, Cultural Engagement Officer at Living Positive Victoria, and as a committee member of the Programming and Activation Committee of the soon-to-be-completed Victorian Pride Centre. Welcome to Word for Word, Brenton Geyer. So, Brenton, I wanted to chat to you today about your life, your history, your contribution to the Melbourne scene in so many different ways, events and clubs and that sort of thing. But let's go back. Let's rewind right back to little Brenton. Where did you grow up?
Well, I call it the misfortune of being born in the mid-north of South Australia in the 1960s. A little town called Kapunda, which is nestled in between the Barossa and Clare Valleys, which sounds idyllic, of course, but in those days, the Barossa and Clare Valleys weren't the wine districts, the producers of lovely pâtés, wines and other gourmet treats that they are famous for now. The 60s and 70s in those areas were pretty bleak, culturally barren, I call them.
When you say little town, how big are we?
2,000 people.
That is quite small.
Yeah, the status of Kapunda declined when the copper mines closed some years ago. The town was built around a copper boom, like a gold rush. Here.
So once that was
Victoria
done,
had the gold rush. We had the copper rush. So, and when that was all done and dusted, the town declined rapidly. And at the height of the town's success, I suppose you'd call it, there were five pubs in the main street, and they're still there. And I've been into every one of them on a weekly basis growing up, because that's all we did, was go to the pub. That's what most of the town did. Social life was based around the pub. Certainly, if you were like me and were foreign to sporting clubs, football and cricket and tennis, there was really nothing to do. So that's why I say I had the unfortunate experience of growing up in the country in the 60s and 70s.
But I guess in a way you could sort of reframe it and think, well, I know what that's like, and I know what this very small Australian and very Australian town with its five pubs and its sporting focus, I guess that's given you rise to understand and appreciate the other side of things now that you're living in inner city Melbourne.
Well, I suppose you could say I've come a long way.
You sure have.
In every way, culturally,
yeah.
Socially. Yes, geographically not so much, because I did have ambitions of being somewhere else by the time I became an adult. But Melbourne suited me, and I've been here for 30 years now. But I did escape Kapunda at the first available opportunity when I left school to seek out the bright lights of Adelaide, which turned out to be not so bright really, and which is why I ended up in Melbourne, where they were quite bright for me.
So you were about 17 when you went off down to Adelaide,
mm-hmm.
was down, yeah, because
yep.
you were north.
It's
Do you
correct.
Have any family left in Kapunda?
My parents are deceased. They both died within 6 weeks of each other about 3 years ago.
Wow.
And I am remaining over there is my younger sister and her family of 4 children who are now adults, and they have, she has 2 grandchildren.
So you still have reason to go back?
No, I don't have any reason to go back at all. And I don't go back at all. I keep in touch with my sister through social media, and in fact the whole family, now that Facebook's such a thing. We're in constant touch through social media, which has been great.
So when you lose your parents, and particularly both within a few weeks of each other, how does that change the family dynamic, or did it, because you weren't actually living amongst things with your sister anyway?
It really caused us to bond, my sister and I, to bond over this. We were very distant. I was never a family person, still aren't really. And having left home quite early, away from the family unit, I had no reason to keep in touch with them. The whole country lifestyle became more and more foreign to me, and I, as I became more absent from it, I didn't have this emotional pull to go back and be a part of the family. Like, my sister did that for us. My sister did those hard yards in terms of being the good daughter. I was not the good son. But upon the death of our parents, we found that we came closer and closer and closer, and we're now very much good friends, which we weren't before.
If you weren't interested in the sports side of things, what did you do with your time, say, as a primary school student, Brenton?
I feel I had to create my own escape. Sporting is not an escape. It's being in the present, I guess. But I wasn't able to do that by choice and by ability. I had the unfortunate disadvantage of being absolutely effeminate. And I say unfortunate because it was at the time for me. It's turned out to be an asset, I feel, and something I've claimed and learnt to love and live with, and not only that, but express openly, honestly, and proudly. But at the time, that young effeminate boy wasn't popular, and that young effeminate boy had to find his own way to be inspired, to be part of the world, the community. I did that through cultural pursuits rather than sporting pursuits. So I developed a love of all sorts of culture, whether it be the written word, the spoken word, film and television, opera, theatre, very young. And that gave me a really good grounding and turned me into the person I am today.
It sounds to me that you embraced the idea of being an outsider quite early. Because you definitely were an outsider. Did other people treat you as an outsider? How did they deal with effeminate little Brenton?
I suppose I don't feel that I was ever bullied. I don't feel that I was ever ostracised. I think being in a small community, everyone has to get on. I think my point of difference was very obvious. But I don't feel that it was ever a disadvantage to me in terms of being bullied or harassed. I was never gay bashed or accused of being a faggot or any of those other homophobic behaviours that can be put upon queer people. That didn't happen until I got to Adelaide. In Kapunda, I was pretty protected from all of that.
By who?
By the community, but by my peers at school, in my small social life, and by my family. I never recall any situation where I felt that I couldn't be who I was, although I wasn't allowed to go into their world. It's difficult to explain, isn't it?
What's your take on, say, nature nurture? You know how when we were younger, we used to talk about, are we born gay? Are we produced?
There's no doubt in my mind that we're born gay, or we're born to any sexuality, or we're born to any gender. It's the nurturing bit that fucks it up.
Yeah, that's a good point. I like that.
Upon my parents' 50th wedding anniversary, I had to make a speech. And for those occasions, I did go back to Kapunda. Weddings, funerals, anniversaries, that sort of thing. I had to make a speech. And I said that the most beautiful or precious gift that my parents or any parent can give a child is freedom. And I was very lucky that my parents gave me absolute freedom.
And you didn't abuse that?
Oh, yes, I did.
You did?
I was naughty. I continue to be naughty.
I chatted to someone recently who theorised that gay kids are the good kids because they don't want to bring attention to themselves and so they're always very well behaved. You're not proving that point at all.
No, I was very good at bringing attention to myself and still am.
Why do you think that is?
Oh, I don't know. Is it an ego? I'm not a philosopher. I don't
understand. Performance?
There's an aspect of performance in my recent past, and there may be in the future. I don't know. We don't rule that out. We were going to make a buck somewhere along the line. And I think perhaps I was really lucky in the sense that I was born with a sense of being a show-off. I think that's an asset, and I think it's been an asset for me.
So what I'm hearing is your parents didn't really judge you. They just accepted you for who you were, as the town tended to, and that wasn't a massive burden for you.
I don't think they judged me. I don't think they understood me. I think there was a bit of eye rolling going on and a bit of a sense of what have we got on our hands here. But I wasn't like some gay people growing up forced to change my nature. forced into religion or conversion. None of that went on. Perhaps they just didn't know what to do with me, so they just let me go, which is nice, I think.
Yeah, I think, you know, what else can you do with a child except support and let them be who they are?
They gave me everything I needed. I never went hungry.
Did you ever discuss this sort of stuff with them? Like, did you ever sort of sit down and talk
never.
About your femininity or...
Never.
Just accept it and move
never,
on?
Never, ever.
Wow. No. What sort of high school student were you?
I was studious. I was a bit of a split personality at high school. I was an A student in the humanities. I was a D student, a complete failure in the sciences.
I can relate to that. Totally relate to that.
I didn't bother. I didn't care. I attended physics and biology classes, but I didn't listen. I mucked around. But in terms of English and history and geography and other classes, I was rapt. I was completely focused in those topics, so flourished in those classes.
Did you have a little group of friends, like a little posse of people around you?
I suppose if you want to call it, want to put a term to it, I suppose we were the nerds. We certainly weren't the jocks.
And teachers, what was their approach?
Oh, well, they had no choice really but to do their job, I suppose. I didn't put any barriers in the way of them doing their job, other than being in science class and biology class and not really doing anything.
Given your lack of skill in the sciences, what did you want to do? What were you thinking about doing when you were, say, 13, 14? Did you have any aspirations?
I think from the word go, I knew what I wanted to do. And it was a new, pretty much an emerging vocation at the time. And I worked out that it was called being an interior designer. So I set my focus on that. So when I did leave high school and move to Adelaide, I was lucky enough to be accepted into uni to do a Bachelor of Arts in Interior Design.
So when you moved to Adelaide, was that the first time you lived out of home?
Yes.
Talk me through that. Was that a bit of a culture shock or like moving from somewhere like Kapunda to Adelaide? Or was it exciting?
It wasn't a shock. It was something that was inevitable for me to do, something I had to do. My parents offered to buy me a car if I was to stay living at home and commute to Adelaide. I couldn't think of anything worse. So I declined their offer of a car and moved into Adelaide into a share house situation with other students, and it was great. The party began.
In terms of your sexuality, was it something in Kapunda that was kind of just lurking around and then you went to Adelaide and was, you know, I'm almost an adult and, you know, let's just go with it?
Not quite immediately. There was a lot of searching, a lot of discovering, a lot of working out how it all worked. I still felt, even in Adelaide, I still felt a little bit alien because I didn't have a network there, and that took a couple of years to form. It formed quite wonderfully and beautifully and successfully. But there was a period, and I think it's not unique to me, I think it's with everybody growing up and finding themselves and discovering who they are, a period of uncertainty and self-discovery and also frustration because you want everything now. You want it right now. You don't realise, of course, it could take 30 years to get that, to get what you want, but you did want it right there and then, and it was a frustration that I couldn't achieve that sense of community and bond and tribal belonging for a few years later, but I did get there.
Was that kind of a lonely time for you, or you just knuckled down and
studied? Was lonely, yeah. I think I was most lonely when I first moved away from home to Adelaide and was finding my feet there. It was, I don't often reflect on these things. I've moved on so rapidly that speaking to you today is causing me to really think about how I felt back then. And I can remember certain circumstances where I did feel lonely. I don't think that was a bad thing. I don't feel that was unique to me.
Passage, I reckon. Like, I remember going to uni, I was quite young, I was 17. A green suburban girl had not, you know, I didn't know that certain foods existed and that sort of stuff. And I remember at the time, I was in the closet when I was at high school, didn't really understand my sexuality, and I remember thinking, when I go to university, I'll just be myself, I'll cut my hair short. Do you remember having those sorts of embracing who you were?
Well, actually, now that you've mentioned that, I do recall that I didn't know who myself is or who I wanted to be. My feelings were that I don't know who I am or who I want to be or how to get there. So that I think that was my biggest frustration, of finding my own style. I guess the term is being comfortable in your own skin. I wasn't. Took a few years.
What would you say to that Brenton now that you are very comfortable in your own skin, you embrace it? What would you say to young Brenton?
I would say to young Brenton to take more risks and not be worried about the risks, not be worried about being different, not be worried about standing out, not be too shy and not to worry about the consequences of standing out, even though but in the bigger scheme of things I certainly did stand out, but there were other people around me who stood out much more than they were aspirational to me. They were inspirations to me, those people who stood out more than I did. But I didn't know how to get there. I didn't know how to achieve that. It just wasn't in me. But I had to develop a sense of self-resilience, self-confidence, and a thicker skin in order to grow into that person who I wanted to be.
And developing a thicker skin, does that come with time and experience, or can you just kind of flick a switch and go, you know what, I'm not going to worry about what people think, I'm just going to be who I am?
I don't think you can do that. I don't think it's possible. I think it's about walking in certain shoes and down a certain path, and I'm using a lot of cliches here, but they kind
it's
of work.
They work.
Yeah. To develop resilience and that thick skin is a journey that one must go on over time. You can't flick a switch. There isn't a switch. Because if you did, and if it would be pretending and it wouldn't work, I feel.
Speaking of cliches, there's that classic one about you can't be what you can't see.
I suppose that's what role models are.
Yeah.
If you don't have those role models, then you don't know where to go with it. I suppose so, yeah. I've certainly used role models in my life, still do, in order to strive to be the person who I should be and want to be and can be.
Yeah, I don't think as adults we ever sort of give that up. We might, even in our 50s, we might see something that really impresses and we might grab a little bit of that style and grab a bit of that style. And, you know, that pastiche makes up who we are as people.
Still do.
Still
all
do,
the time.
Absolutely.
I'm still finding inspiration in other people all the time.
Yeah. How long were you in Adelaide for? Did you finish that degree?
For the duration of university. I worked as an interior designer. I graduated. I worked as an interior designer for a short time and realised I didn't like that industry. I liked the design process. I still do, and I still practice that, but not professionally. I worked in the design industry for a few years, but didn't like the industry. So I didn't know what to do, but I developed enough in myself and in my confidence as a person to make the decision to move to Melbourne.
It sounds to me like you were going to move away from that industry. Did you have a plan? Like, did you have a job?
No, I have no plan at all. I still have no plan. I've never had a life plan. I was listening in awe to somebody recently who had a plan about in 5 years they would earn this money and they would be married, they would have this house and then they'd have another house as an investment, then they'd have two children and then they would live in Tuscany for a year and then they'd retire. I thought, oh, you've got it all mapped out. I couldn't think of anything worse at all.
I think when you have such a stringent plan, you're kind of opening yourself up to disappointment when something doesn't go to plan.
Or a beige life.
Yeah.
Where is the experimentation? Where is the excitement of the new, of the unexpected? If you stick to this plan, I could never possibly do that. I had no plan when I moved to Melbourne. I didn't have a job. I was lucky to have had a couple of friends who led the way, and I was able to stay with them while I found a job. And I found a job, and found my own way into Melbourne to create the life I have now, 30 years later.
What was the first job you had when you arrived in Melbourne?
I had some contacts from my design days, some fabric wholesalers who travelled a lot sourcing fabrics around the world to sell on to interior designers and architects here in Melbourne. And I ran their showroom for them while they were away travelling.
What suburb did you land in?
I landed in South Yarra because apparently in the 1980s, we were in the 1980s by this point, the early 80s, apparently according to people in Adelaide in the early 1980s, South Yarra was the only place to be. And it probably was at that point. So I thought, we'll go there. It didn't really take me long to realise that that wasn't the place for me. I soon ended up in St Kilda, and I'm still in St Kilda.
What was it about South Yarra that didn't suit you?
I felt that I had to be propped up to go to the corner store to get milk on a Sunday morning or whatever. I felt that everyone was too pinched, too proper, and I'm sort of like that anyway, but I like to think that I can wear a pair of slippers and not do my hair to go to the milk bar. I still do. I was the bottle shop.
So you've been in St Kilda for how many years?
Oh, well, I think it must be 25 years.
Tell me about the changes you've seen in St Kilda over the years.
Oh, it's been like a roller coaster of gentrification and non-gentrification. It's been when I moved in there, and I really don't think of my life in terms of years and figures. I think of events. So the Prince of Wales still had sticky carpet and was still a barroom brawl sort of Wild West place where stools would be thrown across the room and all the licorice, all sort of society had cluster, which is the best sort of bars in town. All the freaks get together. All of the people who are not welcome anywhere else find comfort in their own company, and I love that. So the Prince of Wales became my watering hole, and of course it's now nothing like that at all.
Yeah, what happens to those people when places like the Prince close for a while, renovate, and then reopen as a beige palace?
A lot of them die, and they did in the 80s and 90s, certainly for one reason or other. And it's just that the new ones coming up don't have those places to go to. So, and the old ones who are still around, like me and some of my friends, we just go to the new places. And we adopt the new places.
How do you find new places? How do you make them your own?
Well, they're the old places reinterpreted. So, yeah, we make them our own. I suppose the easiest way to make a gay bar is by turning up.
That's true.
So, you know, if enough gays turn up to a bar, it's a gay bar, in my view.
Because we've lost so many. We lost the Greyhound. You know, the Prince of Wales is changed beyond recognition.
But there's no reason why the Prince of Wales can't be viewed as a gay bar anyway now, despite its transformation into this very mainstream, very smart and elegant watering hole for a different clientele. If enough gay people go into a corner, then that's the gay corner.
And start in social media.
Yeah. I think so. Mm. And I think the management responds to that. Because we're not scary. We spend a lot of money. I think the whole myth of the pink dollar still existed somewhere in some people's minds, especially people who want to make money over the bar. Think, oh, those gays, they spend, they drink, they spend. And that is true for my crowd. So I think if we were to turn up there with a gaggle of gays on a Sunday afternoon or something and claim a part of the venue as else, then I think then they might put a gay DJ on, they might put a little drag show on. I don't think it's appropriate for the gay community to sit back and say they're hard done by because gay bars don't exist anymore. I think it's their own fault if gay bars don't exist anymore. It's up to the community to create our spaces and create our gay bars. That's my view.
We do hear a lot of moaning over the years about, oh, well, this is closed and, you know, why did it close? Mm. You know, look, there might be extraneous reasons why a bar closes. It might be a lease issue or whatever. But, you know, sometimes it's just because we haven't been supporting it with putting our bums on seats in places. Mm.
A lot of people blame social media and hookup apps and that sort of thing for the decline of the gay scene. Well, I don't.
What were some of the highlights of the gay scene in, say, the 80s and 90s?
My regular was the Prince of Wales at that time, and then of course Commercial Road existed in a different form than it does today. There were maybe six gay bars along Commercial Road during that time.
It was a little ghetto at that time, wasn't it?
Yeah. You know,
there was a couple of community groups with offices there. There was a couple of other businesses, but also the clubs and the bars.
Certainly, Hares and Hyenas had a strong cultural presence. The Orso Foundation had its offices in the area. If we start at one end, there was the Exchange Hotel, which bookended one end of the street and Virgin Mary's book ended the other end of the street. And in between that, there was the Market Hotel or Three Faces. There was Diva Bar. There was Outlook Cafe. There was probably more than that that I can't remember. And I've been into them all so many times.
There was a couple of gay-owned restaurants and cafes.
Yeah, as I recall. Yeah, yeah. Everything was gay along there.
Is there nothing left there?
Nothing.
Now? Nothing.
Yeah. Nothing.
And it was a reasonably quick death too, as I recall.
Yeah, the death happened, and I can pinpoint it to the turn of the millennium. As soon as we hit 2000, everything changed for me, and I think it did for the whole scene as we knew it. I call the end of the 1990s the fin de siècle, the end of the Belle Epoque.
Yeah. Where did you go after that?
I didn't go out at all. So that's actually a lie, a big lie. I probably went out three times a week.
As opposed to five.
Yeah, true. We used to go out Thursday nights and get home Monday mornings, but that's a whole other story. Smith Street has picked up a lot of that scene action where Commercial Road left off. Not immediately, but it has now. Smith Street is now where all the queers go to club.
You're listening to Word for Word, and I'm chatting to Brenton Geyer. Do you think you replaced some of your nightlife with moving into sort of a queer career? Like your career spans media and events mostly. I mean, you've done a lot of things. How did you get into the queer media? Because that was kind of the first step for you, wasn't it?
Coming to Melbourne from Adelaide and having to reinvent myself, find my own family, as you described earlier, my own tribe, I had to do something about that. And in search for that connection, I found the Midsummer Festival, which was emerging. I think it was 3 years old. I was lucky enough to find a mate who was on the board, and I joined the festival as a volunteer, and very shortly after that joined as a board member. I was sat on that board for perhaps 10 years, I think. 3 years of those as chair, through the 90s, really.
And then you moved into the festival directorship for 7 years?
Yes. In the 2000s, I became the full-time employee. My title was festival director, being in a much more hands-on role than I was as a board member.
What would you describe that job as? Like, what was the sort of day in the life? Let's go around festival time, not early in the year when you're writing grant applications and acquittals. So around festival time, what's the day in the life of the festival director of Midsummer in those days?
It was running very fast. It was having to be an octopus, having to have hands everywhere and eyes everywhere. It was chaos, but really great chaos. It was the best sort of chaos. And I don't doubt that a lot of that chaos was caused by me. But because I had no experience and skills in running a festival, I learned how to run a festival by sitting on a board. And I just brought my own way of running the festival to Midsummer. And it's a very different beast now. And it has a very different managerial style and a sense of professionalism and a different governance model. We didn't have a governance model back then. We did it on no money with our eight arms and our four eyes in any way we could. And that's the way I loved doing it.
Yeah, that grassroots, everybody pitching in type of thing.
Yeah.
I guess events like that have to kind of get to a stage, and you might disagree with me, get to a stage where they either keep drawing on board expertise and time and the willingness and the passion to be involved with taking that weird step into sort of professionalising it and maybe commercialising a bit, maybe somewhat like Sydney Mardi Gras.
It had to happen. If the festival was to continue on the model that I was running it and others were running it at the time, it wouldn't exist now. It wasn't sustainable. Although I led the festival as the chair through its largest period of growth. As the chair, we moved, we established the first ever major event being the Carnival. The Carnival was at that point on Fitzroy Street, St Kilda, Albert Park Lake. And at that stage, the board was the working board. We were there at 6 a.m. hammering in tent pegs ourselves and all of that. So it's all hands-on. We didn't have Harry the Hirer to do it all for us. And then the year after, upon the success of the Carnival, which was enormous for Melbourne and Melbourne's gay community at the time, there'd been nothing like it. We then decided, well, this has got legs. This whole concept of major events has got legs. We then established an opening night major event to open the festival, whereas the carnival closed it.
Where did the idea of carnival come from? Was it something you'd sort of witnessed overseas, or was this just an idea that you and the board sort of went, why don't we have a gay day?
Well, it was, yeah. It was in direct response to the Ulster Foundation's gay days, which we found were rather lame. We found that event, when I say we, I mean the small group of people who were running the Midsummer Festival, we found that event didn't suit our cultural needs. It didn't speak to us as younger people. We thought the Ulster Foundation was really representative of older people and rather dull people. That wasn't us. We wanted to have a vehicle to show off in a different way. We wanted a vehicle to express the fact that we were celebrating our gay culture in a different way. So we set about creating a forum to do that, which turned into what Midsummer is today, the carnival, and major celebrations such as the Pride March. The Pride March was established during my time on the board. It was first of all run by Midsummer until it became such a success on its own that it was then, I like to say, we gave it wings and let it go free.
And wheels.
And that's right. And the same thing happened with the Melbourne Queer Film Festival, as it was called. When it was under the umbrella of Midsummer, it was the Melbourne Gay and Lesbian Film and Video Festival.
Quite a mouthful.
And Pat Longmore and Lawrence Johnson were running it. It became very successful, and again, Midsummer gave it wings, set it free, and we'll look at it now. It's one of the best queer film festivals in the world, and we established a big opening night celebration for Midsummer by closing Brunswick Street and having a street party. That moved to Commercial Road, South Yarra, for a few years, and then it eventually moved into Federation Square before it... The board at the time decided it wasn't sustainable to keep running that event.
Why do we still need things like, say, Pride March and particularly Midsummer Carnival? Why do we need to still have these giant public events?
Well, I don't know that they offer anything new each year, I'm afraid. I don't see the point of difference from year to year to year to year these days. I think things need to change quicker than they currently are. For me, I think we're just too comfortable in the format. And I don't think there's anybody making any creative decisions around how we want to represent ourselves as a community to the broader community. And I think we're settled into this pattern now of Carnival and Pride March being the big ones. I'd like to see these events evolve and change. And that'll keep me interested. I didn't go to Carnival this year. I felt it was just going through the motions for me.
Do you think it's because, to some extent, some of these events are kind of beholden to commercial and sponsorship interests? Like when obviously their survival depends on funding. I mean, you can't put on something like Midsummer without considerable sponsorship, because basically the queers aren't prepared to pay for it. Like if we had to pay $20 to go to Carnival, I reckon that'd be the last year.
We tried $5. It didn't work.
I remember that, actually. I remember it being roundly lambasted.
It was, yeah.
So if we do have, you know, sort of council sponsors and a commercial sponsorship.
Well, when you say beholden, you're right. We're beholden to the funding streams of local government, the arts funding, the major events funding, which is why the carnival exists. And the only reason that I'm sure it can exist is because of the City of Melbourne support, which is brilliant. And the City of Melbourne have been supporters of Midsummer for forever, right back from my day, where they supported a visual arts program called Queer Street. They supported the carnival. They wooed the carnival from Albert Park Lake to Alexandra Gardens with the support of the major events funding. And that funding has been recurrent for more years than I can remember, which is actually brilliant. Similarly, the City of Port Phillip provide funding for the infrastructure to allow the Pride March to happen. They're not the only avenues of funding.
Do you think that makes us a little risk-averse? Like if we're working in events, do we tend to get a bit risk-averse and not want to really offend those partnerships?
Well, if that's the case, I think it's the wrong position to be in. I think by our very nature as a community, we should take risk and we should experiment and we should test new ground and test new ways of exploring our identities and expressing ourselves as a strong community. I was lucky when I was the chair of the board in the 90s that we were given enormous financial freedom because of this concept of the pink dollar. And we had some very smart people around us. Bluestone Media, which doesn't exist anymore, were running queer newspapers and magazines. And for the first time, tapping into the big corporates, the car companies, the airlines, the telcos. And we at Midsummer also tapped into those organisations and their very generous pots of sponsorship dollars. And so we were able to bring on the motor companies, the airlines, the telecommunications companies and the banks and others in order to produce these major events such as Carnival and the opening night street parties in Commercial Road and Brunswick Street, etc., because we got on the back of the wave of the pink dollar.
There's been quite a bit of, what's the word I'd use, carry-on about a certain bank who has a campaign geared towards Mardi Gras with using basically sort of reclaiming negative terminology. Are we too quick to be outraged about that sort of thing now?
The young people are. I like the idea of reclaiming that terminology. Last year, that bank, and perhaps the year before, were loved and hailed as innovators by introducing this new term called the gay TM. It was not offensive in any way. It was all fun. It was tongue-in-cheek. It was great. I think this is fun and tongue-in-cheek too, but it is more threatening to people to have those derogatory terms and those negative terms brought up again. But in the context of the whole campaign from this bank, it makes absolute sense to me to reclaim those words in the context of the current way that they're used.
Because it's not the first time we've reclaimed words. You know, fag, queer, poof, dyke. Mm. You know, we've been reclaiming words for years. Mm. And I wonder about the outrage associated with corporates reclaiming them for us.
I suspect that within the corporates who are reclaiming those, it's the queer voices that are being heard.
That's true, because there are queers working at those banks. And there are very large diversity and pride groups within those organisations.
And it's sometimes not even the banks, it's the agencies that they employ. The case for this particular campaign we're talking about, it's not the bank creating all of this, it's the agency they employ. And they seek the queer voice, they seek the opinion of the queer individual to come up with all these things. It's not some bland thought process that goes into this. It's a very much in-the-moment thought process from the community that goes into creating these. And perhaps it's just, we were talking about building resilience and thick skin. It's perhaps those of us who have built that resilience and thick skin against terminology like faggot and queer and poof and dyke and those sort of terrible things you're not allowed to say anymore, but that's all we knew at one point. And perhaps it's just us who have built that thick skin and that resilience who like those terms being used in the context of campaigns like this.
I remember going to an also board meeting quite a few years ago, a couple of decades ago probably, and there was a big disagreement over women being involved and anyone sort of under 50 really. How do you see our community as having changed in, say, the last 20 years?
The best thing our community has going for it at the moment is its youth engagement and its gender-diverse engagement. It's a no-brainer that the voice of the youth and the voice of the gender-diverse people are the voice of the future. It's what we need to do. It's where we need to go. And I celebrate Midsummer because they're doing that. They're giving voice to youth. They're giving voice to people of colour. They're giving voice to gender-diverse communities and individuals. And that needs to be their main response in order to move forward and stay relevant.
I remember shuddering at the time at that board meeting thinking, if we go down this path and we don't allow trans people or lesbians to have any involvement in the Also Foundation, it will die a very quick death because those men were getting quite elderly at the time. I mean, it did die out for all sorts of other reasons we won't even try to talk about here. But in a way, that sort of dinosaur attitude has long gone, I think, for most organisations.
And other organisations will be long gone too if they maintain that attitude and that stance around the diversity of and the equity that needs to exist within our communities to survive the youth wave, the next wave. It's their party now.
We need to get out of the way in some
respects. Yeah, I try.
You don't need to try. Now, you worked for Bluestone Media, which later became Melbourne Star Observer, Outrage. You were the contributing editor for both those publications, Brother Sister. So it's quite they're sort of the flagship, well, the only queer media during those times. Tell me about those years.
Again, like having no skills and experience in running a festival, I had no skills and experience in being in the media either. I was on a search to find a community, and this is how I did it. I just got involved with these community groups, community organisations and community media. It just so happens that I had a skill for writing and editing and styling and putting publications together. It just so happens I had a skill for putting a festival together. It was not something I ever set out to do, but I just found myself in amidst this really wonderful creative team of people who were doing all of this, and we all did it really under one roof during the 90s. We had my business partner and I had a design and marketing agency called Grad and Gaia, and we allowed ourselves the freedom to pick up community organisations to come in under our banner, such as Midsummer, such as Queer Film, such as ACT UP, and Brother Sister Newspaper and others. And we were referred to by the queer media at the time often as the Flinders Lane Mafia. We were seen as a kind of an enclave of queer movers and shakers. The crew that were making a lot of change and having a big voice in queer Melbourne in the 90s, I was lucky enough to fall into that and be a part of that and then sort of steer it and guide it to an extent where we have a really strong community presence now through the continued existence of the Midsummer Festival, the Queer Film Festival, and other organisations which have their seeding in the grassroots activity that we loved playing around in the 90s.
There's not a lot of publications left. I know there's Melbourne Star Observer and a couple of other things. Has social media kind of stepped in to replace those aspects of queer media?
No, I think it's a general state of affairs in media across the board.
Especially publishing, hard copy.
Especially print media. Yeah, I don't think that the GLBTIQ community is necessarily to blame for the demise of the queer media. I think it's just the general state of the media across the board.
Now, you said that you dropped out of the career game for several years to muck around in nightclubs and created a drag alter ego as a vehicle to do so. Let's talk about that aspect of your life.
Yeah, well, that was a part of discovering who I am and who I wanted to be, and I formed just out of curiosity. We talked before about role models and people who are aspirational to you, and I loved the drag queens that I saw when I moved to Melbourne, and I thought, oh, I can do that. I want to be part of that. I suppose the theme in my life is wanting to be a part of something and just going in and doing it, and the drag was a part of that. So I developed a drag persona who kind of took over my life to the extent that I couldn't continue a working life. My life moved then into nightclubs.
This was Stella?
And bars. Yes, this is Stella. Yes, yes.
She's quite well known,
well,
Stella.
Yeah, well, that was deliberate. And
when you say you dropped out of work to do it, was that like a full-time thing for you?
Yeah, because clubbing from Thursday to Monday didn't leave much headspace to have a job, to function in a capacity that was conducive to career development. So I decided that's what I would do, and I would survive by being a drag queen. And it's a position where you can survive in. It's not lucrative. It costs you more than you make.
Was Stella someone that shared aspects of Brenton, or was Stella someone that was completely different that you felt you could just embrace because she was so different to Brenton?
Well, I think that's best answered by other people, but in my view, she was completely different. I don't think there was any crossover between the life of Brenton and the life of Stella. I didn't see that there was anyway.
even though she kind of almost prevented you from working in a conventional job for a while.
That's all right. I didn't mind. It was a deliberate action, a deliberate path that I went down.
Is Stella retired?
No. No. She's in a bag in a cupboard. But she'll be back because I've always viewed my life as a drag queen as something I'll carry with me forever. I'm, in fact, making Stella a commodity by turning her rampage through Melbourne's queer life in the 90s into a road movie, currently working on the screenplay for that. It started as a book. In writing that book, I came to the conclusion that this is not on paper. This is something on the big screen. This is something with colour and sound. So it turned into a movie. So that screenplay is at an advanced stage, and it's a long-term project. It won't happen tomorrow. It'll take a few years.
Like most film projects.
Yeah.
Stella give you permission to do things that Brenton wouldn't do?
Yeah, very much so. Although Brenton's been no angel, but Stella took it to the next level in terms of naughtiness.
In terms of your time on the nightclub scene and with Stella and going out, was there how did the use of substances help you through that time? Was that something that you indulged in as well?
It was absolutely substances went hand in hand with the scene, with the lifestyle. It was all about drugs and alcohol. There was never a time when I considered that it wouldn't be, and it would never have been possible without enhancements.
Were there casualties along the way?
Not. That's how you define a casualty. Stella could be viewed as one big casualty. But, that we were running very fast. I say we because we hunted in packs, us drag queens, and we were fearless. And we were looked at in awe and horror and got ourselves into all sorts of scrapes, got ourselves involved in illegal activities and got ourselves out of those scrapes and managed to live to tell the tale, except for some of us who went to the edge, went so far to the edge that they went over the edge. So I was very lucky enough to get to the edge, but no, to walk back from the edge.
Have you ever been arrested?
Yes, I have. Yes, have you? Yes. The charge was being drunk in a public place, so I was drunk in a public place, so I pleaded guilty. But a part of that was spending a few hours in a cell in the Fitzroy Police Station on a Monday morning in drag. So that was a lot of...
Stella.
That was a lot of fun.
Let's change gears a little bit and talk about equal marriage and relationships. You are engaged to be married. Talk me through the equal marriage campaign and that whole popularity contest.
I didn't have much to do with it at the time. Naturally, I believe in and support the philosophies around it and behind it, but I wasn't ever interested in being married until I met Yahia, who was very interested in being married. And my view on life is, well, you don't ever discount anything. You just go with the flow, I suppose. It wasn't on my radar. I wasn't about to go and find a partner just to get married. It sort of all sort of happened. I found myself in a partnership and my partner wanted to be married and I wasn't opposed to that. So I'm very lucky and I'm very thankful to those people who did fight hard to gain marriage equality and equal recognition so that I can benefit and my partner Yahi can benefit from it today.
Are you having a big wedding?
Well, this is the funny thing. I don't know. Of course, we're planning the wedding of the century, but whether that will happen or not, I don't know. He's currently in China, unable to re-enter Australia from having been visiting his family for Chinese New Year in January.
Is that because of the coronavirus?
He's a Chinese citizen who's studying on a Australian student visa, a master's in linguistics at Melbourne University. He didn't get back into Australia before the travel restrictions were put in place, and the travel restrictions are now being further pushed forward. Push back, and we don't know when he will be back in Australia. His view now that he just wants to get married the minute he gets back, which there goes my idea of a big May wedding. I have no preconceived notions about when or in what form this marriage will take place.
just that it will.
Hmm.
It seems quite extraordinary that his life has been interrupted because he left the country to go home, or his previous home, to celebrate a significant event. And now he's basically stuck in limbo. You both are, because of a virus.
Oh, it's not that dramatic. I'm still living my life.
Don't tell him that.
And, well, he's frustrated in that he doesn't have the freedom that he would have had if he'd been here in Melbourne. But we both know that the situation will evolve.
We were talking off air a little bit about Living Positive Victoria, and you are the media and comms officer and the cultural engagement officer, and have done for a few years. We were talking about the coronavirus and the impact on your current role. Let's talk about that a little bit.
We have a duty of care at Living Positive Victoria to our members, some of which, or many of which, are older people in the community who are HIV positive. And we're worried about the effect that this virus will have upon them. So we're working with the health department at the moment to ensure that our community has adequate access to HIV medications ongoing, has the ability to have several months of medication with them at all times, has the right support in terms of getting the flu shot early, and having the right support mechanisms in the case of self-isolation. So at Living Positive Victoria, we're working with other agencies such as Positive Women Victoria and Thorn Harbour Health about how to best address the potential that the coronavirus could have on people living with HIV in Victoria to safeguard those people in our community. It is the job of agencies such as Living Positive Victoria and others to advocate for our community, for those living with HIV in our community, to ensure their continued well-being and continued access to treatments.
You're also on the Programming and Activation Committee at the Victorian Pride Centre, which is in your beloved St Kilda. Why do we need a Pride Centre?
We're all going to need a Pride Centre at some stage in our life. Maybe not all the time, but I know that I would have really benefited from having a Pride Centre when I was an emerging queer boy. It would have given me that physical base from which to meet my peers, collaborate with my peers, form my future aspirational community. I guess it would have provided a bit more of a cushion. And those kids now who are emerging as queer people now have that little cushion, that little support that they can come to in the form of the Pride Centre to collaborate with their peers, to find out who they are and who their peers are for a start, to find out who their leaders are and who to look to for aspiration and inspiration in their community. It's very important that now that we have the ability to provide that facility, that we do it. It wasn't on the radar until now, and we're really, really very lucky to have the people who are working in the background making this a reality and the people who are funding it to make it a reality.
What is in the short-term future for you, Brenton, besides getting married at some stage in 2020? We were talking about your lack of plans. Do you have, like, things that you want to do that you haven't done yet, travel?
Well, I've got my movie in the works, 120 Days of Stella, with apologies to Pasolini. And I am moving house next month.
On the dark side.
Over to Fitzroy. Yahi wants to live in Collingwood. Who am I to say no? He wants to get married. He wants to move to Collingwood. I've been very obliging, said whatever you want, dear. Very happy. It's not as if we're moving to Mars.
True. It's Fitzroy, you know, it's not like you're moving to, you know, Narrawarren or something.
It's still very much...
Apologies to
I can't really think beyond the next few months. I never have, really. I feel that my full-time job is secure. I'm liking it and I'm producing work that I'm proud of and inspired by the organisation that I work for and inspired by the work I do, so I see no reason why that needs to change in the next chunk of time. But really, I've never been one to make plans beyond a handful of months.
I'm envious of that. Brenton, I want to thank you for coming in today. You have been quite a significant contributor to the queer life in Melbourne over many years, particularly things like Pride March and your role at Midsummer, Carnival. You were a pivotal person in the creation of those incredible events that survive to this day, and including your work in the queer media, your work at your current job, and looking forward to the Stella movie. So I just want to thank you for sharing that with me. It's been fascinating. I could talk to you all day. Thanks, Brenton.
Word for Word is presented and produced by Lisa Daniel, with production and editorial support by Tom Morgan from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy. Word for Word is distributed nationally to over 70 stations across the community radio network and is available for download at joy.org.au and anywhere you get your podcasts.
Light me to the safety of your home. Lead the way, lead the way. Lead me down the hallway to your room. I'm alone, I'm alone in some sicko's fishbowl dream. It's just me. So come on, come on, come on, come on. Just so tired of trying to work it out. I need to be rewired, my friends, rewired. Like a broke junkyard machine. Let me tell you, it's dark out on the scrap heap. You know what I mean. Light the way, light the way, light the way. Light the way with nothing but the moon. Lead the way, lead the way, lead the way. Lead me even though you know not where. Cause I'm bone tired. I'm just so tired of trying to work it out. I need to be rewired, my friends. Light the way, tip the dust.